Welcome to the Extra Sequential. This is episode 44, I believe, coming at you from three different locations for the first time in a long time. My name is Chris, and with me is Laladdin. We'll be discussing comics, manga, and all manner of things, X-Men related episode this week. And we're also joined by Matt from the Sequel Cast podcast all the way in the States. So thank you both for joining us.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Matt, and we are looking forward to chatting all things X-Men in the history of their appearances on TV, film, and also reviewing the latest X-Men First Class film, which will be later on in the show. But as usual, first we'll be talking about the news.
Okay, well, first up is Kevin Smith. Looks like he'll be having a reality TV show.
Great.
He looks to be setting up to hooking up with AMC, the network which does Walking Dead, based on the comic, we know, and Mad Men. So it's going to be based around his Secret Stash comic book store that he's owned for the last few years. And he sent out a casting call recently for kind of extras and people that are into pop culture shenanigans. So if I lived anywhere near New Jersey, I'd certainly show up. But I don't know how I feel about this. I think Kevin Smith likes fanboys because he is one. But I hope that's not, let's make fun of the geeks kind of
thing. Yeah, he's never quite been like that, but I do think he's a little bit pandery. What do you think, Matt, of Kevin Smith? He probably hears.
You know, Kevin Smith has worked really hard since his debut film, Clerks, and he definitely has a huge audience. And now he has something, I think it's called SIR Radio or something. It's a network of his zillions of podcasts he does with him and his friends. It's an internet radio station. But I think it could be a bit pandering. I'm kind of expecting the show is to be a little bit we have something here, I think it's on History Channel, called Pawn Stars, where they go to a pawn shop in Las Vegas and they sort of appraise what things are worth. And I'm wondering if there'll be a bit of that, of people trying to sell their old comics or action figures. But I don't know a whole lot about it, but I think because it's Kevin Smith, it'll definitely have an audience.
And there'll probably be lots of profanity and joke about various body parts.
Yeah, hilarious. we'll quickly move on. Well, before we get into the million of DC relaunch news items, I wanted to mention that Mark Millar is just finished scripting his last script for Marvel, and he's announced that he's going to go start his own media empire, evil media empire. He hasn't specified, but he's Mark Millar, for those who don't know, it's probably best known among things for creating for Marvel things like the Ultimates, the Civil War arc, and he worked on the Iron Man film amongst several other titles. He's been a huge boon for the publisher, and he's also had recent success with Wanted, which was adapted into that film with Angelina Jolie and James McAvoy, I think, who's also in X-Men First Class, so that works, and as well as Kick-Ass, which I don't know how well it did at the box office, but it was pretty good critical hit, and Nemesis, which is being updated by being adapted by Tony Scott at the moment. He announced that he's just finished the dialogue for his last script on Marvel. It was a lot of fun, but I'm on full time on Miller World as of today. And then he thanks everyone he worked with. It's been an amazing experience, and I'm stealing all the best ones to work with my own creator-owned projects anyway. In the next 12 months, Kick-Ass 2, Nemesis 2, Super Crooks, Superior, The Dave Givens Project, The Frank Quitely Project, and Hit Girl. So busy things from Mark Millar there for comic book fans. Yeah,
he seems to be another Kevin Smith type character, and that is he's created his own magazine, Clint Magazine, which isn't that great, and in his own convention as well, comic convention, I think, which is called Kapow.
Yeah,
started last year in England.
Not MillarCon.
No, I don't think so.
All right.
What needs?
Yeah. Well, the other piece that got to me this week is that Bleeding Cool reported and Brian Wood confirmed that DC have cancelled Northlanders. Now, this is a series from Vertigo Comics. It's kind of a subdued Viking drama with a mix of dark drama and action, and it's quite sort of low key, and it's just been came after days after he was ditched from Supergirl because of the DC relaunch. So a lot of people are hugely bummed. Vertigo has a history of cancelling titles sort of that aren't huge financial hits, and with the whole relaunch, I think it was probably inevitable that something got discarded. But in the same vein, we've also seen, you know, that that with the DC relaunch, things like Justice League Dark will be written by Peter Milligan, and that'll feature kind of John Constantine, Deadman, Shade the Changing Mad, Madame Xanadu, all these Vertigo characters in the mainstream DC universe, and there's going to be a Swamp Thing number one, Animal Man number one, etc. And for you, Matt, I don't know how familiar you are with Vertigo Comics. They put out Preacher and Fables and Sandman and other kind of well-known ones for not being superheroes, and they're now being rolled into DC, which is obviously well-known for superheroes. Has this does that news surprise you at all? I mean, for us, it was a bit of a shock. I don't know if it's going to impact anyone who doesn't read these titles.
A little bit. I mean, like 10 years ago, I was into the whole run of Preacher comics by Garth Ennis, and I forget who the illustrator was on those.
Steve Dillon, I think.
Steve Dillon. And I also read, I think, the first volume of the trade paperback of Fables.
Lovely.
And isn't Vertigo just supposed to be more like R-rated, more intense?
It's meant to be more creator-owned work, so it's their imprint where creators retain the rights to their characters, and they're allowed more freedom in terms of art, story, and the R-rated content. They're given a bit more leeway. For someone like Hellblazer Constantine, ignore the Keanu Reeves film for a second, but that'll be interesting to see how he translates to a DC universe where he can't swear as often, and maybe the things he's involved with can't be as gratuitous. I mean, I can't imagine Preacher being set in the DC universe.
No.
Yeah.
I think they're doing it just to make things simple.
Yeah.
Because DC Comics is a name people that don't even read comic books might recognize, but Vertigo, unless you've gone into a comic shop, you know, sometime in the past 10 years or 15 years, you might not know what that means, that it's connected to DC Comics at all.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are more familiar with its output and the imprints kind of kept on the down low in terms of not promoting itself too hard for non-comic readers, which in its way has been good. I just hope they stick with the imprint and keep doing original titles on it and don't just scrap it completely, because that would be, I think, a huge mistake.
Hmm. I did want to ask Matt, actually, if he's through just the mainstream channels, I know through USA Today, Hero Complex, and a few other newspapers and blogs and whatnot, this whole DC relaunching that's happening in September, DC actually using the mainstream press to break the news. And I don't know if you've been familiar with the news that's been coming through in the States through the newspapers and that sort of thing.
I've definitely seen in the new a lot of mainstream, like USA Today, news stories about DC relaunching everything and setting the issues back to number one and trying to go for more of a younger audience, because it's typically, not that we're old, but it's typically older people. It's typically older people that go in a store and buy comic books, but you don't see a lot of kids in those. You see these like fat men with beards in comic book stores. Is that the case in Australia too?
Yeah. Ponytails and beards.
Okay. Yeah. You should open a comic store called Ponytails and Beards.
Oh, wow. I'm writing that down.
That'd do well. But I mean, that stuff I knew about, the Vertigo stuff I didn't know about until you just were talking about it a few minutes ago.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting that the whole relaunch has been quite, it's been all us geeks have been talking about online, but I know the big news this week is the Action Comics number one, which is the title that launched Superman in 1938. And most people thought that would kind of be left alone, is relaunching with a new number one by Scottish writer Grant Morrison and artist Rags Morales.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Superman's getting a new costume, so gone are the underwear on the outside. So thankfully all the jokes can be left aside.
Yeah.
He's
kind of just got random lines on his costume now.
Yeah, it's weird. It's almost like an armour. And he's got these big boots that I don't know how he's going to fit under the Clark Kent costume, but it's quite... the other big thing is that Barbara Gordon, who was the original Batgirl, the redheaded Batgirl, which I like from the 60s TV series, Watchmen writer Alan Moore actually crippled her in, 1988? I think a
killing joke,
graphic novel. Joker shot her in the back, so she's been in a wheelchair for the last 20 years. She's now going back to being Batgirl again. So she's out of the wheelchair, which some people find quite controversial because there's very few disabled characters in superhero comics, as you can imagine.
Probably Daredevil was the only one I could think of at a kind of at a random thought. And it's kind of bittersweet because it's nice to see her up and jumping and running again. But I guess it's the thing that made her special was that she used to be Batgirl, and now she's, you know, she's coped with it and become even more awesome as Oracle.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's probably for a lot of us, that's kind of the wow, that they've changed that. And almost nothing else has changed about Batman. I mean, yeah, Bruce Wayne's going back to being Batman, and Tim Drake is still, Tim Drake's still going to be Red Robin. And
with a bad costume. Yep. He looks, I saw someone online said he looks like a rooster. He's got like this cape made of feathers or something. I don't know. And they seem to. It looks like they almost went, here, some random Japanese animation studio, redesign all of our characters and tell you what to, you know, do what you think. That's some of these, they look very anime and manga inspired. But you know, we're picky when it comes to costumes.
Yes.
And everything else.
Well, with the redesigning, and I mentioned this to Chris last night, and I thought it was very intriguing. This probably won't have gotten on your radar, Matt, but are you aware of Neil Gaiman, the writer of Sandman and a million other things?
And he's in a lot of novels too, right?
Absolutely. Like American, American Gods. Gods. Yeah. Great book, yeah. Anansi Boys, yeah, things like that. He recently won a court case against Todd McFarlane about the ownership. Creator of Spawn, that's right, about the ownership of like an ancillary spin-off character, like a medieval Spawn. Anyway, that's sort of opened up a legal precedent for that a derivative character in a comic book can be classed as a new character, and the copyright, you know, stays with Neil Gaiman. So there's been some speculation amongst the professional lawyers who write for Comics Alliance. There's a guy called Jeff Trexler who's been writing some articles there. Sorry, Comics Beat. Who said that some of the idea behind this whole reboot and redesign of Superman's costume could be to avoid the current huge legal battle between the Siegel and Shuster estates about the copyrights and royalties owed to them for Superman. So potentially they have strong legal grounds for saying, no, this is a new character and we don't owe you anything from this point on. So maybe,
when that Superman lawsuit, that's still going on, that hasn't been settled yet, right?
That's right. It's a lot of back and forth, yeah.
And some of it involves about the origin of Superman being from Krypton.
Yep.
Okay.
There's various items which have... There's a lot that's changed about Superman since his first appearance. I won't pretend to be a lawyer, but if anyone's interested, there's some really, really fascinating legal articles over at Comics Beat on this very topic. And it casts another cynical light on the relaunch, if there weren't enough already. All right.
Last news item I quickly wanted to mention is Green Lantern. The Green Lantern film opens on June 17, I believe, and Warner Brothers have released 8 clips from the film this week. So you can see 8 clips from the start to the end of the film. Don't fill me with confidence necessarily, but it's good that they unleashed so many clips. And the animated film, Green Lantern Emerald Knights, is out now as well. Are you looking forward to Green Lantern at all, Matt?
I know nothing about Green Lantern from the comics, and I've just been seeing the trailer, and I'm very confused by the different trailers. It looks like even for comic books, a very convoluted sort of backstory.
And, it's kind of like Jedi's in space, but with power that are lightsabers. But
the trailers aren't helping because some of them paint it like a comedy and some like a weird drama. I don't think I've ever read a Green Lantern comic, and I co-host a comic podcast, so you're not alone on this one, Matt.
Yourself, Chris, do you know anything about Green Lantern? Have you read the comics at all?
Yeah, I'm a big Green Lantern fan, I'm not hugely excited about this film. I think Ryan Reynolds was initially set to play The Flash, but that film got shelved, so he went for Green Lantern instead.
And Jack Black was going to play Green Lantern?
Jack Black was going to play Green Lantern, believe it or not, about 10 years ago, but now he's just sticking to pandas. The film seems to have more of a comedic edge, whereas the comics are epic, you know, on like a Star Wars level. But, you know, that's the one of the things that comics can do that films can't do, is they can...
Sure.
create and destroy worlds with ease. But the film opens soon, so we'll find out soon enough.
I'll get things started on what we've been reading. Last week was my birthday, and I got a couple of comics, which was very nice. I got the first volume of Shade the Changing Man. Cool. Now, for people who aren't familiar with the title, and most people won't be familiar with the title. It's one of the original Vertigo series made by Peter Milligan, who's currently still writing. He'll be writing the DC Dark League spin-off for number one. And so that's why when they announced that, I was like, oh, okay, Peter Milligan's doing it. All right, it might not be terrible. But yeah, this series kind of follows. He's almost like a Doctor Who-esque character. He comes from like a direct dimension outside of reality, and when he comes to Earth, he can sort of manifest images from people's madness into the real world. And the first volume focuses on him fighting this manifestation of American guilt and terror called the American Scream. And yeah, I know, right? it's actually really good fun. This is one of those series that I'm kind of shocked. It was very popular at the time, but so far it's still not been collected in trade paperback collections. It's only the first three volumes out of 10, and I'd say it's probably on the level of like the Hellblazer comics from the period. It's not as good as Sandman, but I'd say it's well worth reading in that sort of vein of comic book and trying different things with crazy concepts of bending reality. And early Vertigo has a lot of horror elements, so this has a lot of that as well. But I'd recommend people check it out, but I also don't want to because I know they can't get all the trades. So if you're prepared to read three volumes of something and then wait several years for Vertigo to get its act together, if they don't get cancelled, check out Shade the Changing Man, Chris.
I've been reading or trying to read a multitude of Flashpoint titles. Flashpoint is the new alternate universe series that DC are doing at the moment. It's a 5-issue miniseries. The second issue came out this week. And it's basically got Barry Allen, who's the Flash, the guy in the red suit that runs fast, in an alternate world trying to convince Batman, who in this world is Bruce Wayne's father, of the world that he came from. And basically Barry Allen wants to get his powers back because in this alternate world he's powerless. Mm-hmm. So Batman sticks him in an electric chair with the chemicals around him, with a lightning conductor sticking out of the chair.
Trust me,
and
bro.
Eventually he gets zapped. And then basically the issue ends, spoiler alert, obviously, that he's a smoking corpse and he doesn't get his powers back. But I assume that he will in the next three issues, but it was quite an interesting title. The other Flashpoint series I read was Aben Sur, the Green Lantern, number 1 of 3, also set in the Flashpoint alternate universe. Hmm. And it's interesting that it's very much like the Green Lantern movie designs. Hmm. Instead of the traditional costume design, so you've got Aben Sur, who you might have seen in the trailer, who's the dying purple alien that gives Hal Jordan and Ryan Reynolds his ring. So he's in that. He teams up with Sinestro, who eventually turns bad in the comics, played by Mark Strong in the film. And we know that Sinestro has his own secret plans. So there's no Hal Jordan in this series. Hal Jordan has his own series. But it's a great-looking book. It's written by Adam Schlagman with art by Philip Messaferra. And, couldn't look more like the film. So I think if you're new to Green Lantern, this, even though it's an alternate universe,
which we're cancelled in.
Yeah, it's actually a good setup for the film itself. I also watched Sanctum, the Aussie cave diving movie.
That's something to do with James Cameron, is that the one?
Yeah.
He's a producer on that one, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he produced it. Yeah, that sounds about right. But, it was bad. Bad story, ooh, bad accents, bad effects. Didn't like it.
Okay. Matt, we're sort of meaning to ask, what's the most recent comics you read or something you want to talk about in that vein?
Sure. So there's a local comic shop, I don't recall the name of it right now, but I go to here in Portland, Oregon, and they're having a sale, and I got a 3-issue miniseries, a spin-off comic of the Starship Troopers movie, but it was written by Warren Ellis, of all people.
Oh, okay.
And it's, I can't think of the name of it right now. It's sort of a prequel comic. Huh. And remember in the movie, Michael Ironside plays like this teacher that has a metal arm.
Yes.
And this kind of explains why he has a metal arm.
Finally.
And the answer is not very interesting. The comic's not so good. But I enjoy Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
And for $3, I had my fun with it.
Yeah. I love the Robert Hyman
and spoilers, the reason why he loses his arm is one of those aliens rips it off.
I was hoping for an accident with a piece of farm machinery or something.
Does he scream to the sky? No! Come on.
Yeah, just about.
Oh, good.
He just about does something like that. You know, it's not like Denise Richards come and bites his arms off. It's nothing so exciting.
I knew she was up to no good. Gary Busey could do it with his teeth. Anyway.
That's true.
Oh, no, it was Jake Busey.
Gary Busey will star in Starship Troopers 4.
Yeah. I meant Jake Busey. I keep mixing those two up. He's in that, yeah.
Oh, the son, right.
He's in it, yeah. That made more sense now.
And the other comic I read recently is all the news about Darren Aronofsky dropping out as director of the second Wolverine film.
Mm. Oh, yes.
I got the trade paperback. It's just called Wolverine, but it covers the classic Frank Miller Wolverine Japan storyline.
Mm. Nice.
Yep.
Where it's, I think, drawn by Frank Miller and then written by Chris Claremont.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I've never read that one before. And I really enjoyed it. I think as if they did it as a movie, which I think they're still going to, it could come off as a bit melodramatic with all the romance and sort of the love triangle that happens in there. But, you know, Japan's certainly a different setting for an X-Men or Wolverine movie.
Oh, yeah.
And getting the character of Wolverine far away from the other X-Men, you know, might make a more focused picture as we talk about some of these other films later on in this extra sequential episode.
Very nicely done. Well, I think now's the right time to move into the feature topic, X-Men in TV and film.
Welcome. This is Stan Lee of Marvel Comics warning you to look around you, your classmates, your friends. You never know which one of them may be a mutant, a person born with strange and wondrous powers. Mutants. I hate them.
You were mentioning in an email, and I threw up a link, I guess, in your Facebook page about... There was an X-Men cartoon called, Kitty Pryde or something?
Yep.
It was a one-shot. And in that, Wolverine is an Australian-Canadian?
Yes.
Yes, he's like us.
Yeah, that was from 1989, X-Men Pride of the X-Men, which goes down for great film names that repeat themselves, like Ricky O, the story of Ricky O.
I expected him in that to say, I'm good at what I do, but what I do isn't very nice.
She can't be an X-Man. It's real. If people haven't seen it, that's literally what it's like. It's very jarring.
That was a pretty good Aussie accent, Matt, by the way.
Yeah, very good.
Well, thank you. I do my best from my Crocodile Dundee knowledge.
For people who don't know, the show was never produced, but the pilot was available on video and was also shown syndicated on TV. It has introductions and closing narration by Stan Lee, which is a lot of fun.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And the other voices, Emma Frost has a voice like Bea Arthur. I found it really jarring.
Well, the Golden Girl?
She sounds like an old woman. I guess they just had a cast of five people they always go to. Yeah, as you mentioned, Wolverine is like an Australian sailor. And Magneto is versed by Earl Bowen, who is the actor who I know as LeChuck from the Monkey Island games. But also people might recognize as the kind of shifty psychologist from the Terminator movies.
Oh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's Earl Bowen. So that when I was listening to him, like, who is he? And Toad's in this, and he sounds like Slimer, which really kind of threw me. And, I mean, yeah, Chris, I know you had a chance to check this out this morning. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, it's, it was, as I said, it was 1989. We should say Pride of the X-Men is in P-R-Y-D-E because, yeah, it focuses on Kitty Pryde, who's Shadowcat, one of the young girls who joins the X-Men. And she shows up in X-Men 3, I believe. She's the girl that walks through walls.
Ellen Page, yeah.
From what I saw, the animation was actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I assume it was done in Japan or somewhere, but I've only seen like the first 10 minutes of it, but I'd actually like to watch all of it.
Yeah. I think it's surprisingly well done. I guess most pilots are, though. I'm sure the quality of the show would have dropped drastically.
And that's, years later, I guess, led into the cartoon, 1992 to 97 cartoon, which most people would be familiar with. Before the first film came out of X-Men in 2000, most people, I think all of us, probably grew up watching this before or after going to school. Mm. And it's actually, Marvel's longest-running cartoon, 76 episode they did, just called X-Men. But yeah, I actually remember that. I can still picture the theme song in my head.
I know, Matt, you've been watching With your previous episodes of Sequel Cast, you were looking at Ghostbusters and a few others, yeah. And you were looking at a lot of, Saturday morning cartoons. I guess I'm sort of wondering, how does the X-Men compare to those in terms of animation quality and writing and all of that, if you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, so a few years ago, those X-Men Marvel cartoons finally came out on a DVD in the U.S. at least. And I bought, I think, the first volume of it, and the animation is very limited. I'd argue the animation's worse than even from that 89 X-Men pilot,
yeah.
Which was its own separate thing. But I think the writing is okay. They tried to do some of the comic book stories, and certainly yes. They have the looks of the characters down right. And even though you might have a stupid voice, like Gambit in particular, I think that sounds awful. I realize he's supposed to be New Orleans and Cajun or French or whatever, but that one never quite worked for me. As a kid, I really liked it. I recall they aired the first like two episodes of X-Men, and the cartoon, over and over again during the summer in the United States. So I was only familiar with those first two episodes growing up. I never got to see the actual show, or the rest of the show when it came on. But I think it holds up better than some of the other stuff. I'm a bit curious to see how that Spider-Man cartoon of that same era holds up today.
Yeah, I actually learned that there was a crossover, believe it or not, between the Spider-Man cartoon and the X-Men cartoon.
They were supposed to have existed in the same universe, so the cartoons, yeah.
And it was also, the X-Men cartoon was also, as you said, Matt, it was they used quite a lot of the comic scripts at the time. So you had Dark Phoenix, that kind of stuff.
X-Men, it's not the first time they appeared in cartoons. In 1966, they appeared in the Marvel Superhero Show, taking the place of, they used the Fantastic Four script. And they added the original X-Men characters, so Angel, Beast, Cyclops, and Iceman, and Marvel Girl. They appeared in a Submariner episode of the Marvel Superhero Shows, which every week would cycle through. Every day would be Captain America on Mondays, Hulk on Tuesdays, Iron Man on Wednesdays, et cetera, et cetera. Due to rights issues, they had to change them to X-Men. And again, in 1981, they appeared on Spider-Man and his amazing friends.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. And that one, they had Firestar and, again, Iceman and a few others. But I guess it wouldn't be until 89 that we'd finally see the X-Men fully come to life.
An interesting thing about the 90s cartoon was that the first season was a continual narrative, which I think it was the first time done in a Saturday morning cartoon. Like, usually that every episode would just be a one-off. You didn't need to watch the previous. But these ones, like the comics, all had an ongoing narrative, a story arc going. Yeah. And characters had their own arcs and that kind of thing.
Payoffs for other storylines later down the track.
Yeah, which is obviously how comics tell their stories. And I guess the other important thing about the cartoon was that it was pretty instrumental in getting people like myself, and I don't know about yourself, Matt, but into comics for the first time. Like, people didn't really know that X-Men existed until that cartoon showed up. Were you someone that kind of got into comics through the X-Men cartoon at the time?
I knew about Batman and Conan the Barbarian before then, but I didn't really start collecting comics until 10 years later, I guess, when I was in high school. So,
Yeah, even people I know who don't really know anything about comics, their knowledge of X-Men is really from this cartoon, and that's a great thing. Mm. I mean, my girlfriend knows that Gambit and Rogue had like a will they, won't they romance, which is just great that she knows that. I'm very, very happy.
Yes. Well, I think Gambit and Rogue fell for each other because they both had the worst accents in the show.
In the show.
They kind of fell in.
Felt for the mutant blight. Our powers combined. In the same period, and Chris mentioned this and I just had to bring it up, there was a terrible made-for-TV movie called Generation X.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about this one, Chris?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, actually. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Matt, but there was a comic, I think, created in 1994 by Chris Bucalo, and it was written by Scott Lobdell, I think. But basically, it was kind of like a new generation of X-Men, which Marvel do every 5 or 10 years. Mm. And we know Banshee, the guy that screams and has the wings in the X-Men First Class, and White Queen, who's you mentioned.
Emma Frost, yeah.
The X-Men. Mm. Emma Frost, currently the main squeeze of Cyclops in the comics. Those two characters appeared in this film first. It was a low budget, and I mean low, made for TV film. And yeah, Banshee and White Queen appeared in this.
Yeah.
And is it interesting because Banshee was played by Jeremy Ratchford, an actor who also voiced the character in the 1990s cartoon.
Oh.
How's that? So, yeah, this film was released in 1996. It was a pilot only. It didn't go anywhere. You can watch it on YouTube, as you can everything else these days. And it's got a whole bunch of mutants that you've never heard of, so there's no Wolverine or Cyclops.
Yeah, it's all Z-listers, isn't it? It's like Jubilee. Mm. Well, Jubilee you've heard of if you watch the cartoon, but Mondo and Skin. Who are these people?
Yeah, some of these characters. It's interesting because the Generation X comic, which finished in 2001, had a whole bunch of characters in it, but they all had their powers were too expensive to show on the screen, so they basically just chose those who had the cheapest superpowers.
I see.
For the film pilot. So not a formidable team, but and it's set in the 90s, so all their costumes and clothes are, you know, bandanas and bright yellow and red and purple parachute pants and stuff.
I saw this on TV years ago. It stars the actor who played Max Headroom. Mm. And that's the only thing I remember about it. I remember him, he was kind of like he was going into their dreams and just being creep, basically.
Yeah, pretty much.
So very cheap, darkly lit sets. Yeah.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. It might be a bit of a stretch to ask if Matt's seen this one because
I have not seen this one. I recall at the time the local newspaper gave it a review.
Ooh.
And they said thumbs down, don't watch this. So
nice.
And I didn't even realize, even though it was called Generation X, I had no idea it had anything to do with X-Men. So
yeah, I'm guessing there was some Fox told them you can't use the word X-Men and you can't have anything anyone recognizes. It's always the rights for X-Men in particular have been split up between from Marvel. Like Fox Studios have had them for years now. For people who aren't aware of the whole rights ownership situation, that's why you won't see the X-Men meet Iron Man and the Avengers in the upcoming films. So if you're holding out for that, it's not going to happen, people. I'm very, very sorry.
Right. And speaking of crossovers, I was trying to tell this before my Skype connection broke up, is there was that Spider-Man cartoon from the 90s, and we mentioned they did a crossover X-Men episode. They also did a crossover Blade episode, which even though there was not a Blade cartoon at the time, and this was before the Blade movies with Wesley Snipes, and in it they make Blade look Latino, like he's from Mexico or South America or something. And I don't recall who did his voice.
They have
a problem with
race relations.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and the voice they did for is Whistler, the name of his mentor, the sort of older man that was.
Yeah.
Anyway, Blade's mentor, the voice in the cartoon, was by Malcolm McDowell from Clockwork Orange.
Wow.
So
slumming it.
It's a very strange episode of Spider-Man. But back to X-Men. I have not seen Generation X. I'll have to check it out on YouTube.
No, you don't.
It sounds pretty funny. Yes. No? It's not worth even the first 5 minutes?
It's not even for laughs. I'd definitely skip it.
Oh, no. Okay.
I guess the other X-Men cartoons that we should mention before we go into the films, I guess, is the there was an X-Men Evolution, which came out, went for 4 seasons, where the kids were in high school, and it seemed, I didn't really watch much of it, but it seemed more kid-friendly. Yeah. And there's also, which was a lot better,
X-Men Evolution. With X-Men Evolution, I remember that one. That came out about the same time as the first film, and so they used a lot of the characters from that. But interestingly, they threw in lots of cool characters from New Mutants, who I've always been a huge fan of.
Oh, okay.
So Magma, Cannonball, Wolfsbane, all those. Christopher Judge, who plays Teal'c on Stargate, was Magneto in that. It was definitely for a younger audience. Everyone had trench coats and gothic makeup. You could talk about the other ones now. I just had to get that in.
Fair enough. And the last one, I guess, was more recently Wolverine and the X-Men, which actually is quite good. And there's quite a few. I know there was like an episode with Hulk in there and stuff, and that's basically because Wolverine is like, you know, if the X-Men were a boy band, Wolverine would be like the, you know, the lead singer type person. because he's always been the most popular X-Men. So he's basically leading the X-Men. It only lasted for one season, I think. But it was a pretty good Wolverine in the X-Men. It's on DVD now. Yeah. And Aladdin, you probably know more about the Iron Man, Wolverine, X-Men, and Blade anime.
There's quite a few. There's been a few of those so far. And just, with the Wolverine and the X-Men, Clancy Brown played Mr. Sinister, which is great. And Michael Ironside, who we'll be talking about very soon, plays a repeating role as an army colonel. So not stretching it too much because he plays a similar role in X-Men First Class.
Both arms.
But he has both. very good. there was a Black Panther cartoon, which has only been shown in Australia. This is very rare. And that features a lot of the X-Men characters as well. And that's been held up due to legal reasons that it's animated in that kind of motion comic style. It looks pretty cheap.
Yeah, technically it's called a motion comic. It's interesting because, again, last night I was just watching the Astonishing X-Men motion comic, which is based
I've seen some of that,
yeah.
It's very unique looking. I mean, when you think motion comic, but it's actually the animation's quite fluid. And it's written by Joss Whedon with art by John Cassidy. And it's got, again, Kitty Pryde, Shadowcat, she returns to the X-Men. And a lot of kind of what happened in X-Men 3 is based on this.
Oh, you're talking about the anime?
So, yeah. The Astonishing X-Men
motion comic. Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry, I mixed it
up. It's pretty good. You can see a lot of similarities between that and the third X-Men film. Mm. If you see that, pick it up because it's actually pretty impressive for a motion comic that's pretty good, the technology we have these days to make these things look really fluid and believable.
Yeah. With the animes, we'll just quickly get through those. There's a Wolverine 12-episode series, and for that, it's him in Japan on the trail of his former girlfriend. It mixes into the Yakuza, and they really drastically changed his look to the point where he just looks like a cool anime dude with claw arms. But there's an X-Men, another 12-episode series just called X-Men, which just coming out now, and I'd recommend checking that one out. I think it's pretty surprisingly decent. It's sort of it opens with Jean Grey sort of as Dark Phoenix dying, and then the rest of it's kind of Cyclops dealing with her death, and the 90s cast of the X-Men go to Japan to search for a kidnapped girl mutant. So there's an excuse for them to actually be in Japan this time, which is nice. And the level of melodrama is perfect. I've always thought anime had a similar level of kind of contrived relationship drama that X-Men can sometimes have on its bad days. I don't know. But I recommend checking that one out. I think it's really well animated as well. And the characters look like themselves. They're not wearing ridiculous outfits or, changed to be more attractive or all these kind of things. And Wolverine's just a badass, but he's also a bit of a douche. So, which is what you want for a good Wolverine comic. He should be a bit of an asshole, shouldn't he?
Yeah.
All right. I think we should get into the films finally.
All right. Let's talk about X-Men, the first film.
Let's do it.
It was released in 2000. It's interesting because Matt mentioned Blade before, which came out in 1998. So that's 2 years before this came out. And so those two films kind of helped the superhero resurgence, I guess, we're seeing on the cinema screens at the moment, which I'm all happy for. Absolutely. Generally, until, unless Catwoman comes out again. But I remember X-Men came out because this was just kind of before the days where the internet was kind of accessible by everybody, and I had to watch the trailer at my mate's university, and because it was like, the trailer for X-Men is out, and I was like so slow loading, and it took me like half an hour to watch like a three-minute trailer.
Oh, yeah.
And it was interesting, this is the days before spoiler alerts because, so we didn't really know anything about the film at all. I actually watched it again last night and it actually, better than I thought, it does quite a good job of grounding the film in a believable reality. Mm. We've got, obviously Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. I actually quite liked it. I remember when I saw it in the cinema, I was sitting next to a couple of American girls. And when Hugh Jackman comes in, he's like doing the cage fight when he's got his shirt off.
He looks so hot in this film.
They squealed with the delight. They
squeed.
Went,
they squeed. he's a sexy man. What are your memories of this film, Matt? The X-Men, this is the first time it kind of popped on the radar in like 5-6 years. And I was like, whoa, I forgot these guys were awesome. Do you remember seeing this one in theaters? Or
I did. I saw it in theaters, not opening weekend, but maybe a month or two after it came out, so the theater wasn't too crowded.
Nice.
I thought from the trailers and the commercials that the costumes looked a bit cheesy, but watching it now, it does a good job. You know, the first movie out of any of these comic book franchises, whether it's Superman or Spider-Man or what have you, is so difficult because they have to introduce origin stories. And X-Men in particular, you have so many characters.
Yeah.
It's like you're juggling a bunch of balls at once. And which one are you going to focus on? Are you going to drop some along the way?
Mm.
So, and I think the first X-Men does a pretty good job. And I love Patrick Stewart as Professor X and Ian McKellen as Magneto. I think the relationship between them is probably one of the strongest things out of all the X-Men films.
Mm-hmm.
They do a real nice job with that. When I think about this film, the one piece of trivia that sticks out is, you know, Hugh Jackman was not supposed to be Wolverine originally.
Yeah, it was a Scottish actor. He was in Mission Impossible 2. I remember.
Yeah, Doug Ray Scott. That's He's also in a film with Drew Barrymore called Ever After, which is not so good. But he was meant to get the part, and Mission Impossible 2 took forever to film, and because of that, he couldn't break off that film to do X-Men, and Hugh Jackman was the runner-up, so they cast Hugh Jackman instead, and that did wonders for Hugh Jackman's career.
Sure. And it's almost like if we can imagine this alternate universe where Hugh Jackman isn't immediately associated with Wolverine, it's just kind of blows the mind. Like,
yeah. I don't want to live in that world, man.
It's almost like when they had that other actor play Aragorn in Lord of the Rings. It would have just been...
Oh, no. Right, yeah.
Because
in Lord of the Rings, it was supposed to be Stuart Townsend, who was Lestat in Queen of the Damned.
Yeah, the pretty boy in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I remember that.
Yeah.
Another terrible film. So,
I also heard that Russell Crowe was attached.
No.
Was approached originally to play Wolverine.
No!
Whoa!
Oh, God.
Really?
And James Cameron was approached to kind of write and direct. And he moved to do Spider-Man, which also collapsed. And Josh Whedon apparently wrote a draft screenplay for this as well. And now we know that he's doing the Avengers film.
Mm.
And apparently Brian Singer, who directed the film, turned it down twice because he thought, no, comics are just for kids. And then he read the comics and realized I was wrong. And then he said, I can't direct it.
Mm.
So the comics opened his mind, which I'm very happy about.
Speaking of Australians and comic book movies, one of the original people they wanted for Spider-Man was, what's his name? He played Joker in The Dark Knight, Heath Ledger.
Oh, for Spider-Man.
They wanted him as Spider-Man.
Wow.
For the Tobey Maguire film, which that makes no sense at all.
I'm scratching my head trying to imagine. No, just no. He's a fine actor, but oh, God, no.
Yeah.
X-Men, that film has a special place in my heart. I've seen it so many times. And I think it really captures a lot of the elements I loved, especially from maybe Chris Claremont's and work on the X-Men in terms of kind of giving them emotional weight. So you, even if the world's not at stake, say just one of them could get killed, you really feel for them. Brian Singer goes to the effort of giving them all these emotional backstories, and the relationship between Wolverine and Rogue is really central to the film's plot, and I think really beautifully handled by the Anna Paquin and Hugh Jackman. And this whole film, yeah, as you mentioned with Blade, is really responsible for paving the way for films like Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. I think if Fox hadn't taken a chance of this film, we probably wouldn't have seen a serious attempt at a comic book movie for God knows how long. And not everything in the film is perfect. Some of the special effects don't hold up anymore. Even at the time, I felt that the fight on the Empire, the Statue of Liberty, didn't look right.
Yeah, it's pretty lame.
Yeah. And Toad's death at the hands of Halle Berry. Do you guys know what happens to the Toad when he gets struck by lightning?
Yeah, yes.
No?
I know. That's
no?
a bad line, isn't
yes.
it?
Same thing happens to everything else.
Beautifully done. I'm surprised she doesn't want to do these films anymore. I wonder why.
I did want to mention this is the first Marvel film that Stan Lee had a cameo in, even though he doesn't speak in it. He's kind of on the beach when Senator Kelly kind of comes up and he's
been
coming
out of the water. He has a weird old man.
Grant Morrison was writing New X-Men at the time, and he changed the costumes in the comics to reflect the film version, so it was more black leather. But if you look on the extras of the DVD, you can see that they were playing with the blue and yellow costumes, but obviously they didn't do that because they realised it would be a bit odd. But, yeah, I know the costume was a sticking point, but, I mean, it would be hard for them to be running around. Like Cyclops says to Wolverine, do you really want us to go out wearing, you know, yellow spandex? So the leather does the trick for the time.
And they do in First Class. I think we should get on to X-Men 2, which came out 2003, and which, again, by Bryan Singer as director, and develops a lot of the themes from X-Men 1. It really feels like a true sequel. It's kind of like a road trip movie in parts. And I guess we're not recapping the plots because we've assumed a lot of you people have seen these. But in this one, like the first two films, the conflict is really with Magneto. And in this one, you learn more about Wolverine's past, his history with Brian Cox and the experimentation that made him into, you know, the ultimate weapon. And Nightcrawler almost steals the show in the opening scenes with his amazing White House fight scene, which is probably one of the most memorable kind of action scenes for me in any superhero film that I can really remember and go, wow, that still looks really good. Yeah. Chris?
I do also remember the scene where Magneto breaks out of that his plastic prison. The guy's the security guard got the iron in his blood. I thought that was pretty cool.
The new X-Men film kind of plays on some of that, like the bit where Mystique feeds the guy the drink with like iron pellets in it. There's similar little bits and pieces of kind of imagining how to use their powers in creative ways in the new First Class film as well. So it's which was nice to see. But Matt, X-Men 2
does a very good job of you have a much larger cast than in the first X-Men film. And you kind of have the older X-Men like Wolverine and Storm, and you sort of have X-Men the Next Generation with Iceman and Pyro and some of those characters. And this is the longest out of all the X-Men films. X-Men 2 is about 2.5 hours long.
Wow.
So and I think they use that to good effect. It's I think it's certainly one of my favorites of the series. And they do so much with Wolverine's origin that it made me wonder why they even bothered with the X-Men's origins Wolverine. But we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, for a lot of people, they probably rank this one as their highest X-Men movie. I'm kind of torn between this and the first one. And as you mentioned, it's just amazing how they actually managed to balance this huge cast of characters. And nearly just about everyone has an arc of some kind. They learn something or they find something about themselves. And I guess with these two films in particular, we should talk about Bryan Singer introduced that whole subtext, which he kind of borrowed a little bit from Chris Claremont about likening mutants to gays and the kind of discrimination there. And I think that surprised a lot of people seeing these films that there was kind of any subtext to X-Men. I think people had always assumed it was just, watch out for Magneto, the master of magnetism. or Magneto, as I call him sometimes. The homosexual subtext, and that's not something they've shaken off, but I've noticed they ditched it in the Wolverine movie, because I think people don't want to associate Hugh Jackman with that kind of subtext, I guess. I don't know if he has some role in that, but in X-Men 1 and 2, it's particularly strong, and it gives the film a core that kind of... You can review a lot of the dialogue in that sense. There's the scene with Iceman and his parents, and they've asked, well, can you try not being a mutant? And that's, that works in both those ways. I think there's a lot of clever stuff going on with the script here to give it these kind of layers.
I agree. You know, they do a strong job of handling it, and like you mentioned, it's subtle. It's not like you have a character named Rainbow Man or something running about. You know, there's a line, a phrase they use in X-Men First Class where the characters say they're mutant and proud, and I think that's a little bit on the nose for me.
They say it like five times.
Mystique or Raven or whatever they call her. It says it quite a bit, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But, no, I agree. I think that's great how that's dealt with. And even in the third X-Men The Last Stand, they deal with it a bit with the concept of the cure.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just... we handled not as skillfully, and I guess X-Men 3 had a history of directors dropping on and off. Darren Aronofsky was going to work on it, then Alex Proyas, Joss Whedon was going to direct it, Zack Snyder was going to direct it, Matthew Vaughn, who then went on to do First Class, and then Matthew Vaughn actually hired Kelsey Grammer as Beast and Vinnie Jones as Juggernaut, and then he was booted off, so that's his... That's what's left over from him. And I liked Kelsey Grammer as Beast in that in X-Men 3, so yeah. I guess we can thank Matthew Vaughn for that. But it's always a good sign when a film has directors jumping on and off. inspires you with confidence in what they're about to do. X-Men 3 had a $210 million budget, which made it the most expensive film to be made at that time.
Wow.
Do you guys think the money was well spent?
I think it looks cheap.
Cheap and nasty. Like a $2 whore.
X-Men 3, cheap and nasty. No.
It is unequivocally pretty bad. I know Chris is a defender.
It's better than Wolverine.
Yeah,
I'd agree with that. Yeah. I think I need to watch it again because a lot of people say it's the worst of the of the series, but I'm trying to figure out why people say that, and I can't really. It's been a while since I've seen it.
I think it's like if X-Men 2 had been a spectacular failure, it probably would have been as good as X-Men 3. And there's all these subplots that don't mesh. All these characters who there's no payoff to their story; they're just there. It's like got all these elements, and there's just too many, and it pulls the story apart in these ways that you don't have any feeling about the film after you've just watched it. You're like, huh?
That's kind of like Joel Schumacher's X-Men.
What?
Okay. So much stuff and so many characters in there.
Yeah. And also Nightcrawler was just randomly absent. And they said it was because his part was so minimal that the studio couldn't justify the costly makeup and all that, so they just cut him out.
X-Men 3 is also the first Marvel film that has a post-credits scene.
Ah.
So guys would have stayed behind in the cinema after that. Basically... We know in the film Professor X gets ripped apart by Jean Grey, if memory serves me correctly, when she goes kind of Dark Phoenix like she does in the comics. And then after the end credits, we see that he's transferred his consciousness to a guy in a coma and he speaks through another body.
To Moira MacTaggert, and now that's ruined with X-Men First Class. They kind of wrecked that. Also in this film, Cyclops was suddenly killed off, and that's due to James Marsden having to play the memorable role of that guy Lois Lane was married to in Superman Returns. You guys,
I don't
that?
Mind that they killed Cyclops in this film. I mean, it's difficult because they never really gave him too much to do.
Yeah,
but it wasn't even clear that he got killed. You didn't get a big funeral scene until maybe half an hour after he gets killed. Nobody seems to care that Cyclops is gone.
At the very end, he has a tombstone next to Jean, the woman who killed him. But yeah, it's like no one even mentions it. And when Professor X dies, like the world goes into mourning, and it feels like that anyway. With that, and it just feels like, oh God, maybe they planned to bring him back at the end, and it didn't work. I half expected him to rematerialize at the end when she dies, or to rise like the Phoenix from. Oh, never mind. It's not even worth talking about this film for too long. But I know Chris.
Yeah, Chris, you had a good point about this X-Men Last Stand. In that there's too much going on, not with the characters, but the plot lines. Because as I recall in the comic books, the Dark Phoenix saga went into outer space.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you had planets blowing up, and it was very, very epic.
Yep.
And here they focus some on that, but it's more about, well, Jean Grey is called Phoenix now, and she's a bitch.
Yeah.
And and furthermore, darker. You have the storyline of The Cure, which I found very interesting.
Yeah.
But they never quite mesh. It doesn't.
Yeah, they're like two different plot lines which they just sort of jam together like toy cars, just hoping it would work. Doof, doof, doof. And it, if they picked just one thing to focus on, maybe this could have been a good film and cut out some of the weirder parts to it. Because I guess it had potential. It's sad to see a film with potential turn out to be not great.
Seems to be practice in the superhero films that with every film they get more and more characters and more epic and longer run times and stuff. But do you think they would have learned by their mistakes from after the Batman films in the 90s? But I guess not.
It's like they double the number of X-Men in every X-Men film almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Batman fans thought they had it bad with like two villains in Batman Returns. Or three if you count Max Schreck. No one counts Max Schreck. I'd like to talk a few seconds about X-Men Origins Wolverine, which is Will.i.am's filmic debut, and I think he was I think he was wonderful in it. I don't know about you guys. Let's talk about Will.i.am.
Black Eyed Peas.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did that film have an original song by Black Eyed Peas playing during the credits, like a rap?
Like... Yeah, I did, and I think it was called Snicked. No, it didn't. I don't know.
You delivered that so beautifully. I was like, really? It was almost like a Will Smith moment from the 90s where he used to rap in every one of his films. And when I heard Will.i.am was in this film, I'm like, okay, they could make this ultra cheesy. But they chose not to.
His superpower is rapping.
It's directed by Gavin Hood and mostly shot in Australia and New Zealand. So I guess it has that going for it.
And like every big budget film shot in Australia and New Zealand, Australia and New Zealand viewers can chuckle to themselves at the familiar TV actors they see on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
Where have I seen that guy before? And they always put on dodgy American accents.
Yeah, Brian Brown might pop up, or one of the actors from Water Rats. These are Australian TV shows which got cancelled in the 90s, and these actors just need work. I'd hire them if I was filming something there. But
is Brian Brown still alive? Is that the actor from FX, or am I thinking of someone else?
No, you're right, FX and FX2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right, with
There's
the clown.
An FX2?
And the Cocktail with Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And the Gorilla movie with Sigourney Weaver.
Okay, let's not read his whole filmography. He's not even in X-Men Origins. do you guys recall when this film was released? A month before, an unfinished work print was leaked to the internet.
Yes.
With unfinished special effects. So it was like maybe 80% complete. And it was downloaded roughly 4.5 million times. By the point that the film was available in theaters, and a lot of people thought maybe that soured people's expectations for this film. It's an unusual case in that, yes, there's a lot of stories of a lot of films leaking, but not before they're finished. And I guess because X-Men films rely so heavily on special effects, do you think in any way this played a part in souring people on the film, or really it's all the film's fault, Matt?
I feel it's the film's fault, but I mean, you look at the box office grosses of X-Men Origins Wolverine. It actually didn't do that bad. It made quite a fair bit of money, not as much as X-Men Last Stand or some of those other ones, but it did well, and I think that's on the strength of the Wolverine character.
Mm.
The one bit of this film I really enjoy is the opening credits where Wolverine and Sabretooth through the different, through like Vietnam and World War II and Civil War, all these different settings fighting together. And I thought that might have, if they would have made the movie about two brothers that are mutants that are assholes to each other, they happen to be in the army through different wars, and they're trying to keep their powers a secret, and one keeps on trying to screw over the other.
Mm. That would have been, see how easy it is for us to dissect the film after it's come out?
I think what's interesting about this film is because Marvel Comics, and the head of Marvel, Joe Quesada, who's a former artist, knew that this film was coming, and he was pretty adamant that he wanted, because Wolverine's origin for a long time, since he debuted in the 1970s, hadn't been told.
Mm-hmm.
It was like he was mysterious, and that was kind of the point of his character, and Joe Quesada knew that the films were going to tell his origin.
Right.
So he said, I don't want the films to tell Wolverine's origin before the comics does, so they trotted out this series, which is actually pretty good, and we see some of those elements in the film, and it was basically called Wolverine Origin, and it was, I think it was a 12-issue series that told Wolverine's origin for the first time. I think that didn't end up happening in the film, but it was good.
Yeah, it's odd that, I mean, X-Men 2 focused pretty heavily on Wolverine's origin to the point where you saw some major flashbacks, and this film recreates those flashbacks and then just kind of fills in the space between them. It just feels like such a pointless exercise when we already get it. Yes, he was a mutant. And as Matt mentioned, if it had focused on another plot line with a younger Wolverine, maybe less, I mean, he's still violent later on, but maybe less of a penchant for just, stabbing first and questions later. Do you know what I mean? But I think we can all agree that Hugh Jackman is the sexiest in this film out of all the X-Men films. Matt?
He does. You mentioned no homosexual material in this film. He does run around naked through the escaping the military base and jumps off a waterfall or something.
That's
Which reminded me of what Arnold Schwarzenegger did in the opening of Red Dawn with John Belushi. He ran through the snow.
Oh yeah,
isn't in
the bathhouse.
Yes, correct. That's right.
These two films have nothing else in common except that, I guess. I didn't expect this film to be so not fun. I don't know if that makes it, like, it tries to be kind of crazy and silly, but it doesn't go far enough in that way, and the plot's so flimsy that you can't really care about anyone in it. It's just a lot of special effects, some of which aren't very good. His claws look like just like rubber. I think Wolverine's just way more fun when he's in a team atmosphere and he's kind of forced to care about someone for the first time in his life. Like the first two X-Men films, he's fun because, yeah, he actually wants to protect Rogue and he actually wants to protect Jean Grey in the second one. In this one, he's just he has a girlfriend who he screams to the sky at when she dies and then wants revenge, which isn't quite the same as... I mean, at any point, he'd go, oh, okay, I don't need revenge. I'm just going to Japan, which I could almost see Wolverine doing. It seems kind of aimless to have a character like that and not have people to protect. Because he's not the most... as a character, he can be a little bit weak if he doesn't have the right people to play off, is what I'm getting at, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
I think the biggest two things that people found with this film was Deadpool, played by Ryan Reynolds, is pretty much nothing like... in appearance or personality, like much loved comics counterpart. And also, there's no time in this film. It's supposed to be set in the 70s or 80s, or is it? Like,
yeah.
There's like a... Where does this sit in relation to the other films? It's an origin film, so it should be set before X-Men and Professor X shows up at the end. And they do explain his amnesia quite well, but it almost could be a standalone film and not have nothing to do with the other three X-Men films.
Yeah, and the period just isn't there.
I wanted flares.
Well, we don't want a cartoon version of the 70s, but was this meant to be set in 79 or 78? It ties in with... Is it Five Mile Island? Or is it Eight Mile Island? Five Mile Island. I'm terrible at this.
I believe so. I don't know either.
The reactor or near meltdown in the US around that period. I think that was 78, 79. So that sets it then. But otherwise, I wouldn't have been surprised if a character pulled out a mobile phone, if Will.i.am started rapping. It wouldn't have mattered. Well, I guess there was rap in 79, so that would be okay.
You know, it's actually 3 Mile Island. It's not 5 or 8.
8 Take 5. Oh, yeah.
That was the prequel.
I think 8 Mile Island starred Eminem in there, so...
Oh, very good.
Yes.
Awful.
Ready for this?
Let's find out.
X-Men First Class, that came out last week, tells the story of Professor X founding his school for training young wayward mutants, and also his relationship with Magneto, who turns to the different side of the ideology of human mutant relationships, and that's what's explored chiefly in this film, as well as a plot regarding the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we can get into in a second, and how well these different plot lines work. All right. Chris, what are your thoughts on X-Men First Class?
You're doing so well.
I know.
Yes, First Class, directed, as you said, by Matthew Vaughn, who did Kick-Ass and Stardust and whatever. I actually liked it. It was interesting. Bryan Singer had, it was his idea, who directed the first two X-Men films, it was his idea to kind of do the Cuban Missile Crisis, Cold War setting, I believe, and that's obvious that it, different from Wolverine, is that you can tell quite clearly that this film is set in the 60s.
Yeah.
Which is good, because it gives us a chance to get some kind of proper costume kind of things for the first time. I actually liked this film. There are some cheesy moments in it, like the ball jokes. I thought people in the cinema, you know, he's a professor. I'm not really a professor. Soon I'll be going bald. Hey!
You like a sad trombone sound when he says that.
Yeah. Wop, 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 wow, 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 wow.
And the kids are discussing their code names.
Yeah.
Is a bit cheesy. But apart from that, I actually found this film quite enjoyable. There is, we should point out that there has been a comic called First Class, which is Ron Cyclops, Beast, Angel, like X-Men, but this just takes the name only. It's quite obvious that it's a prequel, I found it quite enjoyable. It takes a while to get there. Like in the first 20 minutes of the film, there's like more locations than a James Bond movie. It's just flipping to Romania and America. But once it gets in its groove, it is quite an enjoyable film for the most part.
Matt? We'll get into more of what specific things we like and don't, but just general thoughts, I guess.
I see, in general. I rather liked X-Men First Class. It left me a bit confused as I'm not as familiar with the comic books. So it seems like a lot of the people on the X-Men are kind of like the D-listers.
Yep.
It's not the most impressive team, but that also helped separate it from the more modern X-Men movies.
Mm. A lot of these characters are kind of the Kathy Griffin of the mutant world. They're kind of they're not hitters.
Yeah.
I would also add to that is I just saw this last week and I need to remember this more. With X-Men First Class, I feel the tone is a bit looser, a bit more comedic.
Mm.
And if the older X-Men movies were more like Star Trek Next Generation with Jean-Luc Picard, this X-Men First Class is a bit more like the original Star Trek series with Captain Kirk and Spock with William Shatner.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that it's a bit more loose. They have a bit more fun with it. And, of course, the X-Men are all younger.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it. I think it's better than the last few X-Men pictures.
Absolutely. This is a film, all my thoughts have been shaped by the fact that this film was completed from start to finish, like conception, pre-production within 1 year. Matthew Vaughn was given an incredibly short time span to create this film. So I can't help but have my opinion of it colored by that. And this film has almost as troubled a production as X-Men 3, but yet I think it's a pretty good film. There's elements in it which I love, and like all films, there's elements in it which I just wish they'd done a different way. The standout relationship in this film has got to be Magneto and Professor X, and it's almost like they wanted to make, when they talked about making the X-Men Origins Magneto film, which obviously now won't happen, it feels like they've combined that film with the First Class prequel projects and made this one thing, which I think is pretty strong for that. I mean, in preparation for this film, I reread some Chris Claremont New Mutants comics, which, similar to First Class, explore a team of very young mutants who haven't learned to control their powers and kind of the teen dynamics there. And this film doesn't really have that kind of approach. It really, the kids are there as padding to fill up the team. So when there's a battle, they can all kind of face off against each other with the other bad guy characters who don't talk. I mean, the characters who are focused on here are Beast, played by Nicholas Holt, and maybe we can just mention our thoughts on Beast here, because they've handled the transition of him looking mostly human, except for his feet, to looking like Beast and having a very odd romantic relationship with Mystique, which I'm not sure is in the comics at any point. I don't think so.
No, it's not. It's in the comics, Nightcrawler, who is the blue devil-looking teleporting guy in X-Men 2. He is the son of...
Mystique and Azazel, is it?
Yes, correct. Azazel, who's the red guy in this film, he doesn't really say much. Beast is quite an interesting character. He's always been one of my favourites, and it's handled quite well, his transformation. Mm. And in the comics, he's always been transforming. Like, he's never stopped becoming more Beast-looking. Oh, okay. In the comics, he experiments on himself, and then he turns blue and whatever, and that appears in this film as well. But I actually thought the Beast makeup and stuff looked quite good.
Oh, really?
He doesn't look weird.
Ooh, I thought he looked terrible.
Really? I liked it.
Different strokes for different folks, but I thought he looked really bad. I couldn't help but laugh. I'm sorry.
You think he looked too much like a Pixar character.
He reminded me of Monsters Inc. Do you remember in Jumanji when the little kid turns into like a half human, half monkey, and the makeup job on him? The makeup job was okay, but that's all I could see when I saw Nicholas Holt in the Beast makeup, and I had to really keep from laughing. So maybe that's just me, Matt.
I think the Beast looked a bit silly. He looked too much like a kitty cat.
Yeah,
but I understand he looks a little bit like that in the. Some of the more recent comics too, which is looking more animal, but the actor did a good job.
Mm.
I almost wished when he turned to Beast, they would have dubbed in Kelsey Grammer's voice when he spoke.
He didn't sound anything like him, and they said he was practiced. He had a vocal coach to help him sound more like Kelsey Grammer, and that's what he said. But I didn't hear that at all. He just sounded like a normal kid. He didn't sound like Frasier or anything. If they got the voice of not Frasier, who plays his brother? Frasier.
Oh, David Hyde Pierce. He was in Hellboy too.
Yeah, but, David Hyde Pierce. Yeah. See, he would have been perfect for a young Beast. Anyway.
There's
a few other good characters in here, like Havoc, who's in the comics is Cyclops's brother. So Cyclops is Scott Summers. Havoc is Alex Summers.
What is he here? Like his uncle?
Well, yeah, they don't explain, but obviously he's not his brother because it doesn't tie in with the film universe that they've already established. But I actually felt that was he's quite a good character. Again, like we've discussed, a lot of characters here and a lot of them are underused and you have a few lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
And you'd imagine if they do a sequel, which they have to because this film has done quite well, that some of these characters will go, other ones will come in and it'll be a bit of a rotating cast.
Yeah. Probably just disappear in the space between the films.
They'll join Nightcrawler in,
Limbo, wherever he went. Dimension X, I don't know.
It's good to see Emma Frost in a film since Generation X in 1996.
Do you think she was any better in this film than she was in Generation X?
Played by January Jones. Well, she's running around with a white bikini for most of the film, and you kind of think, why? But then... once she shows her powers, you kind of understand she's a telepath and turns her skin into diamond. So, and she's quite a pivotal character in the comics at the moment. She's currently Cyclops' lover, which obviously not in the film. I thought Emma Frost was played quite well by January Jones. Do quite a cold, calculating kind of villainess.
Matt, what do you think of January Jones' performance? Honestly,
not so good. She's on a TV show called Mad Men.
Yeah.
Yep.
As the wife of the Don Draper character, and I think she's pretty good on that. They didn't, you know, I think in this movie she's a little bit like Magneto is in the first X-Men film, and he's not given much to do, and he's sort of locked in a jail cell for a lot of it, or maybe I'm thinking of the second X-Men movie.
Yeah.
Second one.
The second one. So I think if she plays a character again in another movie, they'll give her more to do. I just don't recall her using her powers that much other than I guess there's a scene where there's an older man thinking he's seducing her, but it's really just a mental projection.
Yeah.
So that was pretty funny. But it was okay, but I did enjoy Kevin Bacon in this.
Mm. Oh, who ever thought we'd see Kevin Bacon in a superhero film?
And who thought it would be good?
Yeah.
Sebastian Shaw playing the mutant who basically any kinetic energy he absorbs, so if you punch him, he takes on... that he can redistribute that energy back out so he can punch with equal strength. So in this film, he's doing crazy things like grabbing nuclear reactor rods to soak up the energy and getting shot by lots of machine guns, and there's some nice special effects there. But Kevin Bacon, man, I loved him in this film. He was...
Yeah, and he actually sold the... because we see the origin of... Magneto's helmet, which Kevin Bacon uses.
Looks and good,
actually sells it quite well. Like he's
looks like something that guy would wear. Yeah, weird guy. And when they talked about this film being more like a Bond movie, I totally got it with Sebastian Shaw's character. He has like a secret submarine that's hidden inside a cruise boat, which he sits on in like a dapper suit, drinking martinis while goading Magneto, and like it's like he was part of a different film, and those were easily for me kind of my favorite parts of like the fun elements of the film. Kevin, I'm almost sad. Oh no, well I can't. No, I've promised we'd do no spoilers for this film, but it's unlikely he'll be returning for First Class Part 2.
Yes,
Second Class.
And it's interesting because Sebastian Shaw is again one of those characters that's been around in the comics for decades, but hasn't been used for a while. And the same, we've also got we mentioned Azazel, or I don't know how you say his name, the red guy, and also Riptide, who's like the I guess he's.
Does he have any lines in this film?
No,
I don't think he actually says anything. He's like the hurricane guy, but these are all kind of minor characters from the comics, and then they turned into minor characters in a film. So I don't know why they chose them, but nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the other characters, I mean, we haven't even talked about Rose Byrne's Moira MacTaggert's good in the scenes she's in. I just wish she was in more of it because I think she's great. But the central characters really have to be Professor X and Magneto, played by James McAvoy and
Michael Fassbender.
Michael Fassbender, the dreamy Michael Fassbender. He's the new Hugh Jackman of this film franchise, I think.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
And a lot of people are saying that the kind of relationship with those two characters is the best thing about the film, and I'd agree. I think they're both pretty good actors in this film, and even though they're not friends for very long before they become enemies, they're very well developed characters, I felt.
Yeah, it's like it plays off their ideological differences in the best possible way, because that's present in the previous X-Men films, and in this one, because they're younger, it has a much sort of a stronger vibe in terms of the central conflict. Like, it can carry the film, and these guys, they don't imitate the actors they're taking over from. Michael Fassbender definitely doesn't try and do an impression of Ian McKellen, or, you know, James McAvoy doesn't try to do the Patrick Stewart voice. Yeah. But it's fun. Like, I love the bits where Patrick Stewart's like using his powers to pick up girls. Like, and he actually uses his telepath powers to be a total badass in this film. I don't know if you guys saw that, but like the stuff he's doing, I'm like, he has the best powers. And I kind of could see how everyone could rally around this character and go to his school because he's such an awesome dude. I got that feeling. It's not like he's some dry professor in this one. He's just that cool guy. He uses the word groovy in this film, and it doesn't feel forced and silly. So, yeah.
They give him so much, the character of Xavier, Professor X, so much more to do in this movie it's a lot of fun. Where in the older X-Men movies, partially because that character is an older man, he's a bit more like Michael York as Basil Exposition in the Austin Powers films, where he sort of gives mission briefings and says, oh, we need to protect Cerebro, we need to find the secret factory.
Yeah, and he has that map in the previous films, and that's just basically it. He's the guy, this is your checkpoints, go here, yeah. And in this film, more than any of the others, and just with all the X-Men and their different powers, like for once, someone seemed to have thought, okay, these guys have these powers and these guys have these powers. How do they face off without resorting to punching? So there's very few like punch fights in this film. And all the other X-Men films have been, if two mutants face off, they inevitably end up punching, or it's a lame kind of fire versus ice kind of standoff in X-Men 3, where it's just like them shaking their hands and then the director yelling, it'll look good when the special effects are on, guys, don't worry. Like in this, like, you go, okay, how can Beast fight a teleporting dude? And it works. Like, things like that. It's not like rock, paper, scissors where, okay, claws beat Storm's, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that's probably down to Matthew Vaughn's imagination in terms of these fight scenes, and it makes the action scenes far more fun, because even though these mutants don't get to talk, they're effective rather than just being there to take up space and look pretty.
Did you guys notice the three cameos in the film?
I noticed two of them.
Storm was in there.
What?
You mentioned Storm.
What?
When they use Cerebro for the first time. I can't remember the scene, but they've got Cerebro, or the proto Cerebro one, on his head, and you see them kind of Cerebro vision, I guess, different mutants, and you see a small African American child with white hair.
Are you being a racist, Chris? Is this because she's black? You assume she's Storm? Is that it?
It's got to be. How many are there?
Dig up, stupid. No.
So she's in that, and also are we going to mention? It's been out long enough. Let's mention.
Yeah. Okay.
When Mystique is trying to seduce Magneto, which is kind of a dodgy scene when you think about it, it's old enough to be her dad, I guess. But she very quickly, you know, she kind of transforms. Said, "Would you like me when I'm older?" And she transforms into Rebecca Romaine Stamos.
Just Rebecca Romaine now.
Or just Rebecca. Yeah, sorry, John.
Lose the Stamos. Just Stamos. Like she did.
Yes. She and who's obviously the former model actress who played Mystique in the three X-Men films. And the best cameo is Wolverine.
Yeah. So it's not entirely Wolverine free, this film, and it's great.
No, which most people have been raving about, and it's entirely unexpected, which no one expected to see Wolverine going in. But and it's interesting because he doesn't even look Professor X in the eyes, so it kind of ties in, I guess, with the other films. But it was a nice touch, wasn't it?
Yeah. And what he says in a PG-13 film.
I was surprised, but I suppose they let one profanity slip.
they're allowed. I think they're allowed a limited number of them, especially if they're funny.
I think you're allowed it. I believe you're allowed it once in a PG-13 picture.
Yeah.
And you're not allowed to use it in a sexual connotation.
Yeah, it has to be like an exclamation or an yeah. It was very.
That's why they swore in the Transformers the animated movie.
Oh.
But they just said damn in that one. They didn't say fuck.
No, I think they said
fuck. Optimus Prime is dead.
in one of the edits of the Transformers, the animated film from 1986, one of the characters swears or something.
Isn't Orson Welles in that film?
Yes, he does. He's the voice of a
Unicron.
Unicron, a planet, a robot that turns into a robot planet.
He eats planets? No, am I thinking? No,
that's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a robot planet that eats planets.
Well, it makes perfect sense now. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, let's not talk about Transformers. Yeah, I mean, there was a couple of scenes in this film which felt a little bit cheap, and I guess that's because they had to rush it in a year. But for the most part, the effects were effective. What do you guys think of the dialogue and the kind of scripting? Because there's some great bits and there's some bad bits for sure. What stood out to you, Matt, as a memorably impressive?
I thought overall so we're okay with spoilers now, right?
Sure.
If anyone's listening, that we'll probably give mild spoilers. We won't give away the end of the film, so yeah.
All right. Well, I'll say some of the dialogue towards the end in particular seemed a bit cheesy, and there's a scene where a character talks about the state of his legs a few times.
Yeah, it was like from a Vietnam movie. It's like, what?
Yeah, where I thought like Forrest Gump, where he goes, Lieutenant Sinise, and you've got no legs.
Yeah, that was...
and you mentioned before the scene where the little X-Men kids are talking about the teenagers are talking about their nicknames, and, oh, we should call you Magneto. I don't know how to do that and not make it cheesy. It might read okay from a comic book if you're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes when these people say these things out loud, they sound a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah. At least, if they had approached it better, it's fine to say, because I guess they're teenagers and teenagers are dumb, and they'll come up with funny nicknames. So I guess that's probably the only way you could do it and say it's like they're affectionate nicknames that they came up with for the Magneto character, but why would he keep that name? Unless if he was also an immature asshole. A script line that stood out to me, they were talking about the mutants, and they mentioned slavery at one point, like someone was giving a monologue, and they panned to the Darwin character, the only African-American character, I think. Oh, no, well, yeah. There's Lenny Kravitz's daughter. I can't remember her name now.
Zoe
Kravitz, thank you. But they panned directly to him, and I was like, that's a bit on the nose, just a bit kind of clumsy. And there's other lines like mutant and proud, which I guess should be the catch line of this film because they say it every 2 seconds, or Mystique does anyway.
So in this, Zoe Kravitz plays a character called Angel.
Yes.
Yep.
But that's not supposed to be the same Angel that's the white guy in X-Men 3. That's just confused me.
Yeah, I think there's been three different angels in the comics.
Okay.
And the female one that's in this film is a fairly recent character, as is Darwin. They've only been around the comics, I think, about 5-10 years, and not really used much these days. But, yeah, I don't know why they chose her. But I suppose they wanted more females in the X-Men.
Yeah, and I guess... There's always a couple of characters who seem just cast because someone famous has a daughter who they want in their film, and or Will I Am needs something to do, or yeah. So that character felt to me like that, and the decision she makes in this film sort of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah. I agree. There was a couple of I think the film handles the kind of lighter comedic aspects and the more dramatic, like there's a couple of deaths here, which are both kind of shocking in their way that they both happen. Quite suddenly and quite brutally, especially the one towards the end. And obviously there's a, talking about legs, Professor X he loses the use of his in this film, and also there was a people that gasped in the cinema next to me.
Have they not seen any of the other X-Men films?
Well, they... Not, not that the fact that it happened, but in the way that it happened.
Yeah, it was kind of sudden, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like Spider-Man 3 when Peter Parker hits Mary Jane. I didn't think that. That was more funny than anything. But again, I know people found that quite shocking, but this is a better version of shocking. And I also liked the intro of this film, that it tied in quite closely to the introduction in the first X-Men from 2000, where a young Magneto, Eric Lynch, is in the Polish war camp, and he uses his powers for the first time. That was quite good. It tied in.
Was that a shot-for-shot remake of that opening scene?
Pretty close from what I've been... Close, yeah.
Yeah. The fact that I have to think about is, are they reusing the footage or is this new? Means that they
no,
did
I think
it
it's
pretty...
new footage, yeah, because they used a different
actor.
Child.
Yeah, different child actor. So it was, that was pretty well done. So emulating someone else's style can't be easy. So yeah.
There's good costumes in this film, and I thought the last third had some really good action scenes, like you mentioned before, quite epic and more deserving of an X-Men film. Rather than, you know, two people fighting on the Statue of Liberty, this was actually more like an X-Men film, kind of what X-Men 3 tried to be, a big epic showdown. This was more like that. You got missiles and, you know, submarines and all manner of things flying everywhere. People's lives are in danger. You felt like this was an epic, worthy battle.
Yeah.
Didn't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For me, because I was so intent on the kind of the characters, I almost didn't really care too much about how it tied into this kind. The world always has to be at stake in these films, and I kind of wish it didn't have to be. Like, do people only care to see a film if the world's going to end or not? I don't think they do. I think if a character you really love is in danger, it should be enough to be interesting, and hopefully they won't have the world be at stake in every one of these films, because it's almost inevitable that there'll be a sequel to this. And I mean, the world at stake is probably my least favorite part of this film. I mean,
well, I guess they had to do it in this film because this is the first time that mutants go public.
And this film, I mean, the whole thing with them saving the world, and it's always been a theme in X-Men. Should we protect the people who hate us? And in this film, that's sort of expressly a major part of the plot, because in the 60s, everyone's sort of happily sexist and racist, and there's some lines about one of the CIA guys says, "See, this is why you don't have women in the CIA," and everyone in the boardroom laughs, and Moira's like right there, and it's like, oh, poor girl. So I think we've covered most of the good and bad points. Any specific things you guys wanted to mention?
No, I just want to say that it was better than Thor.
I think even though it's PG-13, you know, that means you cannot really have blood, but there are scenes where people get shot, like, directly in the face, and there's no blood, and there are scenes where people are dropped from a tall height and falling to the ground,
that's
and no
great,
blood,
by the way.
And that kind of threw me off a little bit.
Yeah, I guess it would have... Yeah, like, the scenes you mentioned with people getting shot or stabbed, I mean, it's not a spoiler to say Magneto kind of goes on like a one-man army thing, and he's almost like James Bond in those scenes, and for him to sort of be stabbing people with knives, it's in the trailer, I'm pretty sure, so that's not a spoiler. And then no blood, it felt a little bit kind of cartoony. But yeah, definitely, if you want to see Magneto be awesome and use his powers in a way that's really fun, like there's a bit... He doesn't kill the dude, but with the metal filling in the guy's tooth, just fun things like that. I'm like, oh, someone's giving it some thought, you know. So there's a lot of stuff in this film that'll keep your attention, I'm sure, yeah. And I'd say it's not the best X-Men movie, but it's really good, and it's better than X-Men 3 and Wolverine easily. So it's well worth your time. Chris?
Yeah, I agree.
Wow. There was a lot of material to cover there. Went longer than I thought, but that's all right, because we had fun with Matt joining us. And, sorry to keep you for half an hour longer than we'd planned, Matt.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, that's been our extra sequential show. We've had, Matt from the Sequel Cast podcast. Do you want to just take a second to tell people about podcast and where they can reach you? Because I've had a lot of fun listening to your recent eps on Indiana Jones and your teased sequels. Episode for sequels that were never made. Maybe just tell people about what you do. Yeah.
Thank you so much. So the Sequel Cast is a show I've been doing since late 2009. We've got about 50-odd episodes done, and it's a show where I look at movies in a franchise one movie at a time. And, you know, themes usually start out positive, and then we get more bitter as the episodes go on, depending on what movie franchise we're talking about.
Yeah.
And the show is undergoing some changes starting with next week's episode. You can download the episodes from sequelcast.com, or we're on iTunes, and we have a Facebook page. But we also air live on Wednesdays on a Cascadia.fm, an internet streaming radio website, on Wednesdays from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific. But they actually have a studio not far from where I live in the Portland, Oregon. So I'm actually going to get a chance to record episodes in their studio.
Yeah.
As a result of that, I can't have my old co-host on there, Thrasher in Jersey, Jason.
Ah.
They are based on the East Coast of the United States in like Kentucky and Georgia, I believe.
So they're unceremoniously dumped?
Yes. But the new co-host is very good. I cannot reveal yet who the new co-host is. But it'll bring a new energy and to the show, I feel. And when you're live in a studio, or sometimes you guys, you do your podcast live, right, in the same room?
Yeah.
And it's much more easier to go back and forth.
For sure.
In that environment, it's a bit more lively. And the next series of episodes we're doing is focusing on a set of Australian films, the Mad Max trilogy.
Oh, very cool. Oh,
I thought you were going to say Crocodile Dundee then.
No.
Was that you, Matt, who told me you met Paul Hogan somewhere?
I did. In college, I went to a press screening for Crocodile Dundee in L.A. and talked for half an hour with one of the producers and with Paul Hogan.
Wow. So,
has he had plastic surgery?
I don't know if he's had plastic surgery. He's had a lot of sun damage on his skin, looked pretty wrinkly. I was trying to convince him to do a Crocodile Dundee cartoon series. He said he's had offers, but he's never accepted any.
So when he steals that idea, he won't get credited for it.
Maybe Wolverine can join him and the two Australians can travel the world.
Wow. That sounds terrible. I'm the real Crocodile Dundee. I'm the X-Men. No, that's not that.
This is a knife. These are my knives.
Very good.
Oh, yeah, sold. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Chris, do you have any suggestions for future sequel cast episodes for Matt?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Now you put me on the spot.
Yeah.
I just watched the RoboCops. I don't know if you've done those.
No, and you know, it's funny you mentioned that. So many people want us to do the RoboCops.
Oh,
I'm sure we'll do that at some point. There's, I mean, RoboCop, you had two different cartoon series. You had a live-action TV series. And a few years ago, they did a four-part made-for-TV movie. I think one is called RoboCop. Oh, I don't know. One's called, like, Meltdown. It's a bit confusing, but it's a very rich series of films. They've been talking about doing a new RoboCop.
Yes.
But hopefully they will one of these days.
Wow. I've got a terrible one for you. This Sister Act.
Yeah. Oh, no. it's only two of those, yeah?
Yeah, maybe there's a spin-off cartoon. But,
what about Weekend at Bernie's?
Yeah, Weekend at Bernie's, sure.
Yeah.
Two of those you could do. I'm trying to think, out of the ones we've done on Sequel Cast so far, perhaps these movies weren't the worst ones, but these are the least downloaded.
Mm-hmm.
We did a film called Chinatown. It's a detective Jack Nicholson film from the 70s.
Yes.
And he did a sequel in the 90s called The Two Jakes.
So I'd never even heard of that sequel. When I saw that, I was like, what? No.
Yeah, that one's okay, not so good. But, I mean, we do a lot of films from the 70s and 80s and 90s.
Sure.
And that one, I think, was too old and too out of our demographic. So I wouldn't put it against us doing something like Godfather, but you got to do a fine mix. It's tricky.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. That's good. A good one.
Yes. How many of those do they do?
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. And then there's the one
Honey,
where
they shrunk ourselves.
Yeah, the parents got shrunk. And there was a TV show. There was definitely a TV show.
Very good.
So you could waste 4 weeks of your life.
I have to keep those in mind next time I want to kill myself.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for that. Yeah.
Fire up Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. But
excellent.
Very good. I'll keep those in mind.
Great.
Well, what are you covering next week on Extra Sequential?
Possibly Green Lantern, because Maladin doesn't know much about Green Lantern, so I'm here to educate and inform him in my inimitable style.
I got
to
wake up and pay attention.
Are those recent cartoons any good of Green Lantern?
Yeah, the Green Lantern First Flight came out a couple of last year, and that's not bad. And the new one, Emerald Knights, is out now, came out this week, but I have yet to see it. I have ordered the Blu-ray.
Fantastic.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us, Matt. We've definitely appreciated having you here to yuck about
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate it.
Yeah. For our exhaustive look at the TV and movies. And yeah, it's really cool you could join us, especially with the time difference. So yeah, we hope to maybe do a few more of these in the future. That would be nice.
That'd be great.
Great. Join us next week for more Exosequential, and hopefully that'll be either a Swamp Thing or Green Lantern episode as we delve into these character profiles that we'd like to do. So that about wraps us up for this episode. You can find more of the podcast at exosequential.com. We're also on iTunes. You can email us at chris@exosequential.com for feedback. Music for the show is at purgeaudit.com, and I will have played snippets from the trailers of the various X-Men films and cartoons if you're wondering what was that weird little bit of music that was playing earlier on. Thanks for joining us. I've been Mladen.
Yeah, I've been Chris, and I continue.
You still are, yep. And, yeah, thanks a lot, Matt. Thanks again.